Hello, my name is Matthew Earnhardt, and I will be guiding you through these next few weeks on international business. So I'm excited to get into all this content and really discuss international business from different perspectives. We're going to be looking at 12 different companies and kind of going around their website and just kind of checking things out and seeing what we can find about these businesses and then applying those concepts to what we're talking about, what we're learning. So let's jump into this first lesson. And if you have any questions, please reach out and we would be more than happy to answer them for you. So when we start, we need to think about what does international business mean? Is it simply a business that operates on a global scale? Is it a large company like Amazon or Tata Corporation in India? Or could it be something small, like if I had an eBay business and I operated out of my house, could I be an international business? And that's a really interesting question. What is an international business? So one of the other things we have to consider is not only what does the term mean, but how does it differ from other types of businesses? So let's go with a textbook definition. And a textbook definition of international business is, international business is a business that is carried beyond national borders. It ranges from everything from services like coaching or consulting to manufacturing products like the computer I have right here. All of these are international businesses. As part of international business, there are some other terms. A foreign business is a business that's operating outside of its home market. An international company is one that has its operations in multiple nations. So a good example of that will be Toyota. Toyota is not a U.S.-based company, but certainly they have operations in the U.S. and other places. So when we think about international business, we need to think of some of these businesses and how these types of business are just a larger scale of a domestic business. And one of the things that we'll be talking about a lot is how complex these businesses are. And they're very complex. They're extremely complex. And I think you'll see that as we start talking about regulations and different things as we progress through the material. Thinking about businesses just as a larger domestic business, I mean, it does not really give the complete picture. And that's what I just talked about with the complexity that exists. Remember that the foreign marketplace and operating internationally has different things. So we're going to talk about different tax structures. We're going to talk about different regulatory frameworks. We're going to talk about different legal structures. We're going to talk about different political structures, and all these things work together to add complexity to an international business. So one of the things you may be thinking, and one of the questions that we're going to try to answer with each other over these series of lectures, is why would anybody want to do an international business? If it's so complex and if it's so difficult, why do people want to do it? And that's a really good question, and that's one that hopefully we'll answer. But a simplistic answer, and one just to think about just for the purposes of this, would be, think about the hometown you live in. So right now, I am in a town that's on a lake, a large lake, a great lake, if you will. And I'm sitting here in this small little town in a great lake. Well, if you add, and I had breakfast this morning at this wonderful little local place. Now, that wonderful little local place, their customer base is very small because it's tied to the local area or people who come into this town to eat and need a place to eat. But imagine if they made hot sauce and they sold that hot sauce nationally, just in the United States. Then that's a much larger market, right? That's a lot more people who would know about this local little business. Well, what if that local little business then sold that hot sauce to here and Canada? Well, then that would open it up to a whole other customer base. And then they added Mexico, or they added South America, or their hot sauce was very popular in Asia, or in Europe, or wherever, or in Africa. Then you really, really open up your business, and you have a larger customer base, and a lot more people know about your product, and you're bringing in a lot more money. So sometimes it is worth that risk. It is worth going through all those regulatory frameworks, instability, and we're going to talk about over the next few modules about how stability is something that corporations want and what businesses want. And we will be talking about that. But think about, is the risk worth all that to open up your customer base? And oftentimes the answer is yes, because you'll see there are large multinational companies that exist, and we'll talk about those as well. So when we think about domestic businesses, we need to also remember that they're not immune from international influence. So an international company certainly is a threat to the domestic business. So, I used a restaurant this morning because my eggs were really good. But let's use a candy store, and this will relate to a business we'll talk about at the end. But let's use a candy store. And if you own a candy store in your town, and it's, let's call it Lake Michigan Candies, and you own Lake Michigan Candies, you still have to worry about international companies and international influence that are a threat to your candy store. So, Walmart sells candy, and there's certainly international candy companies that are out there, and large candy companies that are out there, and candy stores. And all of those are a threat to your business as well. So you have to worry about the international products that you import. You have to worry about the domestic products that you import. You may say, I'm only going to stock local candy products. That may be great, but what about the supplies that you use to make the candy? So there's a very famous candy store in the town I live in. And this candy store is a local candy store, and they make their candy in-house. But what they don't get from local is the cocoa, which is used to make the chocolate. That comes from an international market. So you have all these factors and all these influences that even if you're a small local candy store in the United States, you still have to worry about. And that applies to wherever you're at. If you think about, if you live in Africa and you think about your local store right down the corner, you still have foreign influence and you get products internationally. And this is a very connected world. And that's going to become readily apparent. And that's something we're going to discuss a lot over the next few weeks. So let's talk about the forces that are influencing an international business. And you got to think about these as internal forces, and you also got to think about these as external forces. So here's a couple examples. So internal forces are things which are generally controllable by a business. So if a business will take a Christmas off, and what will that mean? That's an example of an internal force that a company will control. In fact, I read an article a few years ago where people in different countries, even though they may not be Christians, they've adopted the Christian calendar, and they take Christmas off, even though they're in a country with a very, very small Christian population, because they support the United States, and people are off for Christmas, for Easter, for certain holidays, and they recognize that, so they've started adopting that that calendar as well. So that's fascinating, but it's true. That's an internal force that you can control. A good example in the United States would be Chick-fil-A, right? So Chick-fil-A has made a conscious business decision to stay closed on Sundays, and they're not the only one. There's other companies out there that certainly do that, but they are closed on Sundays, or if you're in certain parts of the world, Saturdays, right? So they made the business decision to close. Now, that's an internal force that they can control, and that affects their revenue, that affects everything else. Now, one could argue that they're losing a lot of revenue by being closed on Sundays, but somebody could also argue that health and welfare of their employees, labor costs, those kind of things are being affected on the positive side. My point is that those are all internal forces that they can control. So, just as you think about internal forces, there's also all these external forces. So I'm gonna read them because there's a lot, but they can range from economic, financial, sociocultural, labor, technological, physical, and legal. So we're gonna learn what all those terms are, but as you can see, those are a lot of external forces that are affecting a country. So if your candy shop offered chewing gum and a nation changed their chewing gum laws like Singapore did a few years ago, and chewing gum then becomes illegal, well, that is going to affect your candy shop, and that's going to affect your business. So, you got to think about all these external factors which are putting pressure on your business. Another example that is more recent is there's been a lot of talk about a global corporate tax. So globally, a company would have to pay a minimum corporate tax for their goods and services. Well, that is a major component and a major external force that is going to affect a business and affect business models. So these are all things to think about. One question I often get asked is, when did international businesses exist? Like, how long have they been around? And are they more complex today than they were back when they started? And I think that's a legitimate question and a legitimate statement. And if you attend a local university, you're attending here, and you walk around the campus, or you look at a catalog, or you look at different places, and you go different places, you will see that international business is all the rage at local universities. And studying things like international context and global environment and those kind of things, it's become critically important as the world becomes more connected. And the thing to remember is, yes, our world is way more connected. I could pick up my phone right now, use my WhatsApp, and talk to somebody literally anywhere in the country. And that is just awesome that I could talk to, anywhere in the world. I could talk to anybody in the world. I could call my friend in Nepal right now. I could call somebody in China from sitting in a town in the United States. I could talk to anybody. And our world is absolutely more connected. But remember that international businesses go back hundreds of years. And if you think about it, the Ottoman Empire had international trade between Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. International trade with China goes back 1,800 years. If you're in United States schools, we talk about the British and Dutch East India trading companies, which opened trade between the colonial colonies and Europe. Ford Motor Company, which makes really nice trucks. Ford Motor Company has been trading internationally since the early 1900s. And remember, this company was founded in the early 1900s, and they were already trading internationally. And they realized the need to trade internationally. My point is that international trade, even though it may seem like a new concept in the coffee shops or at the universities or all around, it's been around for a long, long time. It really has. It's been around for a long time. We just don't think about it. We think about it now because of all the access we have. Across and globally, all the access we have. And certainly we have a long way to go with access globally. And as our world becomes even more connected, and as more people come online, and as companies develop satellite internet that's going to be global, that like many companies are working on, that's certainly going to be a game changer, and things are going to get a lot more connected and a lot more complex. So thinking about international business, we also need to, as we kind of define the terms that we're going to be discussing and we kind of discuss some of the things that we're going to be talking about over the next several weeks or modules or days or whatever method you use to complete these lectures. But as we look at this, there are several drivers that are impacting international business. There are political drivers, and we already talked about some of these. But if you think about it, there's a lot of agreements out there. There's the European Union. There's the old, in the United States, we used to call it NAFTA. Now it's the USCMA. There's the Trans-Pacific Strategic Economic Agreement. And there's others that are reducing barriers and making it easier to trade between countries. These agreements generally have a winner and a loser, but all benefit from increased trade across borders. In the United States, for example, international trade means cheaper products. For those countries that produce the products, that make the products, what it means for them is income. And it means income from the United States. And it's just not the United States. But it means jobs. It means a higher standard of living. And there's been a conversation among certain nations recently about the concept of nationalism or protectionism. And what this is it's incentivizing businesses to keep jobs in the host nation. And politically, there's incentives for doing so. So a good example of this is Whirlpool. Whirlpool makes appliance products, and they make very good washers and dryers, for example, and refrigerators. So Whirlpool invests over $7.4 billion across its 8 U.S. plants and accounts for 15,000 jobs. $7.4 billion across its 8 plants. I mean, that's significant. That's a significant boost to the region where Whirlpool products are made. That means good-paying jobs. That means higher standard of living. That means all these things for that region. And again, since this is international, that's a domestic example that actually does international business. But that's a domestic example across 8 plants in the United States. But expand that out to an international market. And you can see how businesses do a lot of good and a lot of impact. And these political factors and making it easier to trade between nations and allow for the movement of goods and services make a major difference. So certainly political drivers exist. And additionally, technological drivers exist as well. And I just talked about it. I mean, it's so much easier to communicate. I can pick up my iPhone and I can call anybody I want around the world right now. I mean, technologically, it has made it easier to do business, to transfer goods, to do things. I can use my Cash App, or I can use Zillow, and I can transfer money right now to anybody in the United States or abroad. I mean, that's awesome. That's awesome to think about the level of goods and services and how fast it is to be able to buy something. If I wanted to get a little British flags for a Mini Cooper and have little British flags on there, I could do that, and I could do that quickly and easily. The internet has made it easy to find products. It has made it easy for an educated consumer. If you think back 40 or 50 years when you went and bought a car, it was a completely different experience than it is now. Normally, when you go in, you know what the trade-in value of your car is. You can find it on the internet ahead of time. You can go in. You can say, my car is worth $10,000. This car is worth $22,000. I don't want to pay more than 21. I want you to give me 10 for a trade-in, and I will give you $11,000, and I'll put $11,000 down, and I will walk out with my new car. The internet has really opened up the world of the educated consumer, which makes it harder for businesses to compete, right? They need to really differentiate themselves. They really need to make their products different. So, if you think about that, also Amazon, for example, and there's others across the world, but Amazon is a good example. Amazon allows you to buy almost anything at any time, anywhere, right? And it makes it easy. I can go on my app and I can make a purchase right away. So, these are very, very key drivers of business. So technology is driving business. It's driving the marketplace in different ways. And the internet has really opened up the marketplace in different ways. There's other drivers such as cost drivers, competitive drivers, market drivers. We're going to get into what all those are. But cost drivers may be sharing cost of research and development. So, for example, with COVID-19 and the COVID-19 vaccine, Merck, which is not a U.S.-based company, partnered with Johnson & Johnson. Merck used facilities in the United States to fill the vials of the J&J vaccine. This is one example of pharmaceutical companies, and they're a great example of people using research and development across, but they're not the only example. There's tons of examples out there that you can think of in your country and where you're watching us from of companies that have partnered across and used research and development dollars to partner. There's reasons to do that. Countries offer tax breaks or tax holidays if certain businesses do business in that country. Here's a staggering statistic. Over half of U.S. companies did not pay taxes. Over half of U.S. companies did not pay taxes because they shifted their income to places like Switzerland. Remember that these incentives exist for those countries so they can pay their employees, they can have this higher standard of living, they can do those things. So they're going to do whatever they can to incentivize companies to do business there, to operate there, to have headquarters there. That is their job, that is their role. When talking about international business, one term you're going to hear a lot is the term globalization. So let's talk a little bit about globalization. Let's talk about what globalization is, and let's talk about some of the things that support globalization, and let's talk about some of the concerns with globalization. So in thinking about globalizations, most people think about economic globalization, and that's the international integration and interdependency of goods, technology, information, capital, and all the things that make that happen. That's what most people think about. So those are very good things, is that everything is kind of tied together, right? And you've heard about that. The world is flat, is a comment that's made. Everything kind of works together. But there's also concerns with globalization. And some of those concerns are, we kind of mentioned earlier, is nationalism and nationalistic pride. So that's a concern with globalization. It has social implications. And a lot of people say that it leads to social injustices. And I'm sure you have heard the term the haves and the have-nots. And a lot of people say, well, the haves are having more and the nots are not getting as much. So that's a concern with globalization, and we can debate that at a different time. One of the things to think about when we're thinking about the uneven results is export-led growth has failed to materialize. For example, Latin America has tried, but they have not replicated Asia's success regarding the globalization and offering products. Latin America has tried that and just has not had the same success as Asia. The other thing I just talked about was the gap between rich and poor in the world based on globalization. This is a big word, but we'll use it. Globalization has a deleterious effects on labor and labor standards. So one of the things that is a criticism is companies can move to other nations with lower standards, and it's a race to the bottom. So there isn't an incentive for a country to move their country out of poverty and offer higher wages and those kind of things. Because if they do, then what a company is going to say is, well, if it costs me $1.50 to build this product in this country, then I'll just move this country over here. It will only cost me $1.25. And then eventually, as that $1.25 increases, then that country will say, oh, okay, well, it's $1.25. Now I'll go over here, and it's 75 cents. So those are some of the things that a lot of people will talk about when they talk about the problems with globalization. Some host countries, and we just talked about this, may feel that lower standards are necessary in order to enhance competitiveness and improve prospects for investment and economic development. So that's just what we just talked about. Is some places will say, well, there isn't an incentive for me to raise my standards, because if I do, I'm going to lose those companies, and then I'm going to be forced to go back to the standard that I had before. So, there's a counter argument to that as you're doing that, then you're building infrastructure, you're building things which then can pull you out, and then you can become self-sustaining. But that is an argument against and a concern with globalization. Let's see. Economic growth fostered by globalization may help generate and distribute additional resources for protecting the environment. So one of the things that people will say that's a pro for globalization is that you can protect the environment and do a lot of good, because as you're operating globally, then you're finding better ways to do business, you're finding efficiencies, you're finding ways to reduce costs, which have a benefit for the environment. So that's one of the advantages of it. Free trade enhances socioeconomic development. I think that we can all agree, as long as all economists agree, that when you engage in free trade, that good things happen. When you have that flow of money between countries, you have goods and products and goods and services moving back and forth, that's a good thing, and that boosts an economy. Virtually everybody agrees on that. Data shows that a clear and definitive link between liberalization of trade and economic growth, so the easier you make it for goods and services to flow, then more economic growth is evident. And that makes sense, right? Again, if you make things easier and there's more money flowing, then good things are going to happen. Countries that have rejected globalization are among the most impoverished countries in the world. So we can certainly think of closed systems. There's a few in the world. There's a couple in Asia. There's a couple in other places. There's one in South America that are more closed systems, and they are struggling, right? I mean, they're having trouble because they're a very, very closed market. If they were to open it up, if they were allowed for free trade and allowed for more liberal policies, that could result in different things, certainly. And, one of the things that I want to say is that as we're going through these lectures, one of the things that I do not want to do is let my biases show. I do not want to talk about whether I think that globalization is a good thing or a bad thing. I want to kind of present both sides. So whether a closed system is a positive thing or is a negative thing, I want to leave that to you as the student, as the consumer, as an independent, free free thinker to decide what you think is best based on the material that's presented. So I just want to be very clear that as I present facts, I don't want to present them as good or bad. I just want to present them and then let you determine within your worldview, your Christian worldview, what is good and what is appropriate and what is not. Free trade promotes better and better jobs and more jobs. So between 1990 and 2018, 40 million more non-farm jobs were created than destroyed in the U.S. So 40% more jobs, and that's because of free trade policies. Openness of trade, that may cause some sectors to be non-competitive, and some jobs will be lost, but trade creates new jobs. So you can think about this in terms of economic development, or environmental development and technologies as well, is one of the, as we push for greener and cleaner technology for the earth, one of the things you'll hear people say is, well, that's going to result in a lot of lost jobs. And then the counter argument to that is, well, yes, that's true, but it creates X number more jobs and more opportunity and different things. And you're going to hear that a lot. You're going to hear that discussion a lot when it comes to globalization and then when it comes to environmental, when it comes to other areas as well. I use environmental just because that happens to be a very prevalent thought discussion right now, robust discussion in the United States right now. So that's why I use that as an example. So that is your introduction to international business. But I would be remiss if we did not spend some time, and I may have alluded to this earlier, we're going to spend some time looking at a website and exploring it together and looking at international companies and what makes them international. And sometimes we're going to get very specific, and sometimes we're just going to keep it general so you can go look for yourself. But we're going to do that at the end of each lecture. So for module one, for lecture one, for this lecture, we are going to look at a website called Universal Yums. And the reason I picked Universal Yums was because it was a candy store, and I like candy, and we were discussing candy earlier in the lecture, so I thought it would be a good illustration here. So before I bring up this business, let's talk about them. They send candy from all over the world to all over the world. And they send snack boxes and highlight different countries from all over the world. So you could have a business that in South Korea, and Universal Yums may feature South Korean candy and may ship some of your delicious treats to people internationally all over the world. Remember earlier in the lecture, we talked about how international business and how some international businesses compete with, or most international business compete with, those local candy shops. So even if you have a local candy shop, you will still be competing internationally, and Universal Yums will be one of your competitors. So let me switch the screen to Universal Yums, and then just because I know you want to see my face, I'm going to bring myself up in the corner. So this is Universal Yums, and we talk about it, and we look at this. Over 5 million snack boxes have been shipped. So we talked about it, and what they do, again, is they're going to provide you a different country every month and the snacks and sweets from that country. They're going to give you a book that's going to talk about it, and then they're going to have a bunch of flavors. So what happens? It's a subscription-based service, which, if you notice, a lot of people are going to subscription-based services. And I can give you an example outside of Universal Yums. So I am wearing, I don't know if you can see it, I'm wearing a fitness band. And this fitness band is different from other fitness products in that this one actually is a subscription-based. So it's a new model. And you'll see a lot of people are moving toward that kind of model, that subscription-based model. So anyway, Universal Yums, which is at universalyums.com, is a subscription-based service. You can do it as a gift for 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, or a year. They will ship, and then you get it, and you can snack. So you can hear, you can see here that they have very high approval rating. They have a lot of cool stuff. You can get started. You can give it a box. Obviously, there's a lot of FAQ, but here's where I wanted to go, and here's what I wanted you to see. So you have Monique and Eli and the crazy cat Hanner, and they are the founders of Universal Yums in 2014. So they were working full-time corporate jobs, but they thought about going around the world and traveling, and they started their company, and now they have this business. So so that's about them. And just something else to show you is when you have a universal company, you need to have people that are willing to support you. So you'll look here, they are looking for a marketing manager that can operate internationally, an e-commerce manager, a lead software engineer, and then you can go here to their past boxes, and you can see that they have featured treats from Greece, from South Korea, which I mentioned, from Turkey, from Spain, from Germany, from Ukraine, the Netherlands. They had a holiday one, Italy, etc. So this is an example of an international company, but you may not always think of it as an international company. So Universal Yums, they are competing with your local candy shop. So that is it for module one. And I'm just so excited that you took the time to discuss it with me, to listen to me, to think about some of the things I'm saying. I know you'll have some activities and some other things to do, but hopefully you found this kind of the framework that we're going to use to discuss things helpful. As we move into lecture two, which is on international trade and investment, we'll be talking about the volume of international trade, investing in international trade, those kind of things. As we close out lesson number one, I just want to take a moment to close us in prayer. Let's do that. Dear Heavenly Father, I want to thank you for this class. I want to thank you for the individuals that are watching this lecture right now. I want to thank you for all the work that Christian Leaders is doing worldwide. Lord, the people that are watching this lecture, that are taking these classes, are doing so because they have a heart for you, Lord. They want to have a global mindset, Lord. They want to have an international perspective. They want to understand how businesses work in this connected world that you have given us. So, Lord, I ask that as we close out this first lesson, that you will bless this class, you will bless each individual person, that you will give them strength, that you will give them focus, that you will give them time to devote to these lectures, to these studies, and Lord, that you will help them to be a strong voice for you in wherever they're at and whatever they're doing. It is in your precious and holy name that we ask these things. Thank you so much, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you so much, everybody. We will see you back for lesson two. Once again, my name is Matthew Earnhardt, and I appreciate your time and attention.